We're looking at the question of the transmission. We studied the character of the transgression. So we said the character of the temptation. This is nice. This would be a nice sermon outline. So literally, you know, and Paul always wrote in English alliteration. The character of the temptation, the character of the transgression. Now we come to the character of the transmission. That is, what is the relation between Adam's sin and our own sin? How is it transmitted? We've already said that there's no question about, there's no real theological debate about the one aspect of transmission, that is, physical death. What we're really talking about is the spiritual relation, and historically there have been three principal views. And I didn't outline, but this is not outlined, this is syllabus is due to be revised, or it's due to come out in a new version, updated. But these three principal views of transmission, first of all, is the Augustinian view, and which is carried over in Protestant theology. Now, this is an Augustine view is a realistic view versus a representative view. Now let me remind you, those of you who have, or mention to those of you who have not had history of Protestantism or early Christian centuries, that you recall that the what evolved in the early centuries of the church was a realistic view of the Lord's Supper. That is, that somehow, in some way, and they couldn't always agree on it, and didn't always agree, that Jesus is really present in the emblems. Of course, the extreme of that is Roman Catholic transubstantiation. At the miracle of the Mass, the host become the historic body and blood of Christ, that and nothing else. So that was the word, that gives us some clue, does it not, on the meaning of the word realism as it's used here, realistic view. That is, that to put it as best I know how to put it, that the effects of sin, the spiritual effects of sin, are genetically transmitted, just as the physical effects are. So that sin or guilt or whatever we're going to talk about is really passed on. Now, give an example of the Augustinian view. Now, he was opposing Pelagius. We're going to talk about Pelagius later. This is the Belgic Confession. We believe that through the disobedience of Adam, original sin is extended to all mankind, which is a corruption of the whole nature and a hereditary disease, wherewith even infants in their mother's wombs are infected, and which produces in man all sorts of sin, being in him as root thereof, and therefore is so vile and abominable in the sight of God that it is sufficient to condemn all mankind. Now that is the concept, I'm going to write this down, of inherited guilt. Now the doctrine of inherited guilt is the soul of original sin. You take that away and original sin loses its sting. Really quits being that. Now the doctrine of original sin is more than that, but it is that at its core. That's the basic idea in original sin. Just learn that. Inherited guilt. Do we believe in original sin? Well, I don't. Was there an original sin? Yes. Does man suffer? Are the effects of this sin in some way at least transmitted through the human race to us as a part of that race? Yes. But do we inherit guilt? Now, we're going to talk about other issues, but this is what what we're talking about right now. Do we inherit Adam's guilt so that, look what it says, it's so vile upon the Son of God, it is sufficient to condemn all mankind. Will the unbaptized child, should he die, go to hell for Adam's sin, although he has committed no sin himself? That's the question, the original sin. Is the baby born guilty? Now, the Belgic confession, of course, says what? That yes, it certainly is. It's sufficient to condemn not only this particular child, but all mankind. Now, I put here, this is where my outlining is poor. I put this in here originally to set it off against the realistic view, and so we'll just deal with it since it is here, as opposed to a representative view. Now, in the history of the discussion of views of the Lord's Supper, it was realism versus the symbolic view, Zwingli. Well, here it's realistic versus the representative view. The representative view of transmission is that the effects of Adam's sin are not, the effects of Adam's sin are not inherited in substance, but that rather Adam was our representative, the federal head of the human race. As a legislator in a government assembly votes on our behalf, and as the outcome affects us as well as the legislator, so Adam represented us in the garden. He could have passed the test for us, according to this view. Christ is our representative on the cross. We elected neither Adam nor Christ. Now, let me just teach you something here. This kind of teaching often gets the professor off the subject sometimes, but I'm utterly convinced of the importance of teaching this stuff in the largest possible context, because, you see, these things tend to come in packages. You take one, you take one view of something, you find a whole lot of things going with it. For instance, Augustine, who was a mystic, as you know, a dualist, not only did he speak of this realistic view of transmission, whereby somehow Adam's guilt is infused in us through the genealogy. Augustine held, as does all of Protestant and Catholic theology, of infused grace. Grace is infused from God. And we're going to come to this later. One of the most, if not the most important question we'll discuss in this course is the question of what is the connection between the death of Christ and us? You see, your view, what I'm trying to say is this. A theologian's view of the first Adam usually fits with his view of the second Adam. How we receive the questionable benefits of Adam's sin, in what way do we receive the benefits of the cross? And we're going to be right back to this thing of realism versus a realistic view versus a representative view. For instance, I'll show you what I mean by that, and we'll discuss it when we come to it. One of the questions is this: was Jesus died for us, right? Anybody? You don't believe that? And we are saved by his death or by his blood. Terms are used interchangeably. But was he a substitute who represented us, or a blood donor who infuses us? Do we receive transfusion of his blood in some realistic way? Well, all of Protestant and all of Catholic theology is based on the proposition that that's exactly what happens. What does the Bible say? See what I'm saying? So that part of this package that I'm talking about is the view of the cross, the benefits of the second Adam, the benefits of the work of the second Adam. And so, to summarize what I'm trying to say is that a person's view on this tends to be completely, tends to be realistic on every approach, at every point, or representative of every point. For instance, do we believe in imputed righteousness or infused righteousness? You know what I'm saying? So that's just to give you sort of the framework of some of our thinking, and we'll come to deal with each part of that, each aspect systematically to come to. Now, according to the representative view, Adam represented us. So it's just like if you have you're in the Republic and your congressman votes one way or the other, it affects you, not simply because he represented you legally. That is, the federal head or legal head, you could put federal / legal. This is the view that Adam was our federal head. This is the old term. Use some older. Well, some of them may still use it. If you're reading, for instance, for your term paper, the idea of that, if you can come across this and you're reading Adam is the federal head. That's what it means. That's because he represented us being our father. We suffer the results of his sin. But there's nothing passed on through the chromosomes or through the birth sequence. Now they would not. I'm not really being fair. I want you to listen very closely to what I'm saying. Now, I'm not really being fair to the Augustinian view by saying genetically transmitted or through the chromosome, because they would deny that. But I don't know. I've struggled for years to try to find some other way to say it, because they don't say it exactly. What they do is frankly talk out of both sides of their mouth. If you really suggest that guilt can be transmitted in the chromosome chain. Yeah. They say, oh, no, we're not saying that. But when you say, well, then what does go on? And they don't know. So really, I say it that way, realizing it's not quite fair, but it is fair in the sense that if they have a better way to say it, why don't they say it? Well, the answer is because when you cross the line, in other words, when you talk about Mr. Tedrick's auburn hair being transmitted from his parents. Was it your mother, your father, your dad? We know what we're talking about, don't we? Transmitted, and there's an objective physical reality behind, with, and under the word transmitted. But when you move from auburn hair to Adam's guilt, then you cross the line into mysticism. Understand? To mysticism, because there's no objective reality you can talk about that stands for or stands behind our word transmission. Now the old timers used to say it went through the blood. You heard bad blood? It was transmitted through the blood. I thought years ago, the longest TV series in history, I think, was Gunsmoke. I'm not sure about that. One of the longest. It was on radio for years. The guy that played Cannon, the big fat guy, he was Marshall Dillon. Conrad. Anyway, and I grew up on Gunsmoke on the radio, and then on television. It's always funny to see all the anachronisms. Here's Matt Dillon and Kitty and Doc sitting in the long bridge, and they got this bad guy. They're talking about what makes this guy so mean. And Marshall Dillon says, well, you know, his father didn't treat him right. He had a bad upbringing, blah, 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 which is only about 100 years too early. And it's not what a marshal would have said in Dodge City, Kansas in the 19th century. what he would have said was, well, it's in his blood. They hadn't learned behaviorism yet. It's in his blood. Why, his daddy was mean, and he passed it on to his kid. He's got bad blood. There was none of this psychology. You get my point. It's really entertaining to watch Marshall Dillon talk Freud. So the representative view is this, as I've said. Any questions on that? I did put it here originally just to sort of give a context or to set it off in opposition to the realistic view, to say, you know, to help us understand both.
So in the Augustine view, the baby miracle view,
yes.
Those who hold this view, what do they do in terms of maybe dying or something? I mean, they just consign them to hell, and that's all they can hope for. Or
well,
like the Baptists, if they believe in this type of doctrine, and they don't believe in, you know, they believe that you have to ask Christ into your heart, and how do they? There's no hope for a little baby to die.
Well, what happened? And
what would they say?
You'll recall, you've had my church history courses. You'll recall this be reviewed. This, that you see, the doctrine of original sin was adopted. Well, Augustine made it respectable and codified it. Well, it raised that very issue. What about the unbaptized infant? So, you recall that the schoolmen, scholars, the in the age of scholasticism, Thomas Aquinas mainly, they created a place to put the unbaptized baby. What's it called? Also study this in eschatology. Limbus infantum, or infantum, it's called both. Limbo. And there's nothing in the Bible that suggests that. It was simply a logical deduction. That is, if you have an unbaptized baby who's born guilty of Adam's sin and therefore cannot see God, but it doesn't quite seem right to put the little kid in hell. So what do? Well, you create an in-between place where there is no suffering, where there is reasonable happiness, but they never, as they to use the language of the Roman Catholic theologians, they never behold a beatific vision. That is, they're not in hell, but they're not with God either. They're in between, limbo. Well, what happened was with the Protestants, the Protestant Reformation, they kept original sin, but threw out limbo, along with purgatory and rosary beads and a lot of other junk. Well, the problem that the Protestants had, are you with me? Since they kept original sin but throughout limbo, they had no place to put the unbaptized baby, so they had to put them in hell. It was Calvin who said, and Luther, that their infants in hell on a span long, the span's length of your hand. Now, see, so they really have that doctrine. They don't talk about it very much. Now, what about the Baptists? You raised about the Baptists. So they're the Anabaptist tradition. And they really had a problem, because they kept original sin but got rid of infant baptism. You see, if you're going to keep original sin, the least you can do is keep infant baptism. That is, baptize them as soon as you can, lest they die. But what do you do if you keep, are you with me? In other words, the Protestants, is the mainline Protestants, the Lutherans and the Calvins, they kept original sin. They lost limbo, but the Anabaptists lost even infant baptism. And that creates a real problem for them. Plus, and they kept the doctrine of infused grace, so that Baptists tend to baptize children a lot younger than we do. That is, if a child has faith, That is evidence of regeneration in Baptist theology. So, if a child has faith, has obviously been regenerated or saved. If it has been saved, therefore, it's a candidate for baptism. And there's a big debate, continuing debate in the Southern Baptist Convention, for example, between those, they have a thing called child evangelism, And they're baptizing babies, their children 5, 6 years old. Some churches are, some preachers do. Why? Well, the kid seems to believe, and he couldn't believe if he weren't saved. So if he's saved, he needs to be baptized. And other Baptist preachers say, well, there's, you know, they object to baptizing 5 and 6 year old children, but they don't have a good reason to. They just object, so they continue, you know, debating that, and they can't really agree. And Baptists, what they say is, you ask them about, well, what about the child who dies at the age of 3? Never been baptized, yeah, but saved or not. And what they say is, they simply say, well, God will take care of it. God knows. See, but remember, I hope you understand this. The problem is original sin. If you accept original sin, then none of the biblical soteriology is meaningless. You either have original sin, or you can have New Testament Christianity. You cannot have both. And this creates all kinds of confusion. But that's the one thing they will not give up is original sin.
If baptism though has nothing to do with the forgiveness of sins, why do they need to be baptized?
Well, because to demonstrate salvation. In the Baptist church, you mean? In most Baptist churches. Since they're saved. Well, did I answer your question? Any other questions? Okay, now. Here I summarize the Augustinian view. You all need to learn this terminology. We're not finished with the doctrine of original sin. It is much more than inherited guilt. What I'm saying is this is the core of it. This is the sine qua non. You take away inherited guilt and you don't have original sin. Okay. Inherited guilt. Now, however, it went beyond that. According to Augustine, this is the Augustinian view, because of Adam's guilt, and this is a comprehensive definition of original sin, and that is that man is born three things: corrupt, and all men inherit corruption, bondage, and guilt. Now let me talk about these three. Here's the difference: corruption, bondage, and guilt. Guilt we already talked about. We know what that means: guilty before God. Secondly, the child inherits bondage. Now, that word bondage has to do with the will. That's what we're talking about. Remember Luther's fundamental work, Bondage of the Will? Okay. So bondage speaks of the will. Guilty, a will that is destroyed, no free will. Corruption means the tendency, the overwhelming tendency to sin. The overwhelming tendency to sin. A good Augustine, a good Protestant, for instance, when his 2-year-old child in the high chair throws a tantrum, will very often say, well, that's just the old Adamic nature coming out. I'm not making that up. That's really true. Pardon? Who did?
Swindoll.
Yeah, Swindoll. Yeah, the old Adamic, that's exactly what they teach, the old Adamic nature. That is, the child is evil. Child is evil. Now, why? He was born corrupt. Now, let's take these one at a time. Corruption. Universal corruption or total depravity. Now, look, here's Palmer, this modern book which I've used a couple of times. He says this: to be totally depraved, however, does not mean that a person is as intensively evil as possible, but as extensively evil as possible. It's not that he cannot commit a worse crime, rather it's that nothing that he does is good. Evil pervades every faculty of his soul and every sphere of his life. He is unable to do a single thing that is good. Born that way. The spirit has been polluted, tainted, made depraved, filled with sinful tendencies. And he cites Psalm 51:5. This is David's penitential psalm. In sin did my mother conceive me. Job 14:4. Okay. Bondage means, as I've already said, total disability of the will. Palmer writes, you see what I've tried to do in this syllabus, students, is I've tried to put in the old standard foundational creedal statements, and then modern, as well as modern writers, to show that really when you talk about original sin, you're not an archaeologist. These aren't fossils, these are living creatures. By the way, you see it in the Sentinel Star this morning. They found the sea creature that was supposed to have been extinct 140 million years ago. They found one growing called a living fossil, which of course is gibberish for something that cannot be there but is. Anyway, these aren't living fossils. These are living fossils, if you're right to say. Okay. Palmer writes, not only is man unable to do the good by himself, he is not even able to understand the good. He's as blind as Cyclops with his one eye burned out. Cannot even understand the good. Cannot want to do the good, cannot want to do the good. Cannot want to want to do the good. He has no concept of what it is to want to do the good. Deader than a doornail. If a man is not regenerated, he cannot understand. Ah. Now that's Palmer. That is Baptist, that is Protestant theology, it is Roman Catholic theology. If a man, the unregenerated man cannot understand. Now that of course is mysticism, pagan mysticism. Why? What if it is true, students, that the unregenerated man cannot understand? What does that say about saving faith? What does that say about conversion? How does faith come? But that's impossible, of course. How can faith come by hearing? How can the word produce faith if the unregenerate cannot understand it? This is what I mean when I have said a couple, three times, at least 100 times. The Protestants have never taught salvation by faith. That's the slogan. They've said the word, but they've not taught it. What they have taught is that faith, they've taught faith by salvation. Understand? If you mean salvation by faith, that faith produces faith leads, faith is the cause, salvation is the effect. Faith leads to salvation. They've never taught that. What they teach is salvation leads to faith. Because if the unregenerate cannot understand, what do you have to be before you can understand? Be regenerated. Now what they actually teach what they actually teach is that a man can understand normal things like 2 and 2 equals 4, but he can't understand spiritual things. Which of course is pagan dualism. And then guilt, I've already talked about that. Every infant bears the guilt of Adam's sin. If it dies unbaptized, it will be eternally separated from God. I mean, now, again, let me show you how this really gets into some very practical things. You all know James Dobson. Dr. Dobson, this is very good stuff on the family. This is from a Focus on the Family magazine that he puts out. This is the September 85. Dr. Dobson answers your questions. He said, question, which was somebody wrote in, was this. I disagree with your views expressed in the July issue of your magazine, in which you discuss the sinful nature of children. While I recognize, as you do, that all children are born into a world filled with sin, I do not think they share the guilt of Adam's disobedience. You apparently believe that children are sinners from the point of conception. But in my view, this would imply that a two-year-old who dies is spiritually lost. Moreover, such a position could be used by religious radicals to justify physically abusing children for their sinful actions. Please respond. His answer is, you have misunderstood my point. I certainly agree that children are without culpability, that means guilt or blame, until the age of accountability. And then a child would go to heaven if he died before coming to a clear understanding of right or wrong. So what he's doing is that he's hedging. This is he's typical thing. He's not a college, but he's a Church of God or Baptist. But he is. He goes on. He denies that a child, he says, you know, that a child would be okay. Now, he's not a good theologian, but listen to this statement. Remember I talked to you earlier about the language that most would object? His training is in psychology. He's not a sophisticated theologian. This is why I'm reading this to you. He's answering this question. So what he does is he tends to use language that some theologians from his camp might shrink back from. He says this, quote, the inclination to sin is in the genetic code transmitted at conception. The inclination to sin is in the genetic code transmitted at conception. That's pretty clear, isn't it? I see, that's corruption. That's the doctrine of corruption. Now, so that's not, it's not just a dry, distant academic issue. And by the way, and he gives his, I'll deal with this in my family life class, but he says, he raises the question, why does every child challenge the authority of his parents? And the answer that he gives is because of his Adamic nature. Sinful little booger, rebellious, slow heart. Why? Tendency to be evil. He got along with warts. I mean, along with freckles and cut chin and, you know, curly hair. And his meanness. Yeah, I'm gonna say it's. Well, don't ask me to make sense out of it. Because if it says if a child is sins from the womb, then why is he not guilty? Well, but when a child, according to that, well, here's what he holds: when a child, when a three-year-old defies its parents, that's an evil act. Now he would back off and say, well, he's not accountable for it. But is it still evil? It doesn't answer the question, why is he not accountable? Well, but I just wanted you to hear that language. Because that's exactly what it's taught. Now, the opposite view of this, of the Augustinian view, was the Pelagian view. Pelagius, we study him in church history, Pelagius opposed Augustine, and he, as opposed to bondage, corruption, and guilt, he said a baby is born pure, free, and innocent. The opposite, exact opposite on every point. Pure, not that is, he's not corrupt. Free, he's not, his will is not bound. Innocent, he is not guilty of the Adamic sin. That shouldn't be too hard to grasp. Here are the particulars. The only consequence, according to the Pelagian view, the only consequence of Adam's sin are indirect. That is, through the environment. Man is born a blank tablet, no tendencies or moral leanings. He is, should be, blank morally, spiritually, epistemologically. The Pelagian would most likely believe that a baby is given a spirit after conception. A fresh creation. And Augustine is more likely to believe in traducianism. Now let me, more likely to. It's the old theological question of ensoulment. When does the soul, when is the baby an eternal soul or have it, when does it become a living soul or have a living soul? What modern issue has brought this debate to the fore, of course. Abortion. Abortion has really created interest in this subject, and it ought to. Now, there are two basic views of this, of ensoulment. One is the view that Pelagians tend to take, and that is that God creates the soul at conception, or sometime thereafter. In the early stages, those who believe this view, this is the Roman Catholic view, I believe. Well, yeah, they talk about enlivenment, which is maybe not the same thing, but in any case, the other view is called traducianism. Traducianism is the view that the soul is inherited, that the soul is intrinsic or inherent to or inherent in personhood, and that the soul is genetically transmitted. Just as you inherit, that is, an inherited personhood from your parents, your ancestors, you inherit the soul. So what I'm saying is, you understand that? Now, the Bible doesn't explain. Don't ask me which I am. I do not know. The Bible does not explain it. All I know, but I don't think you have to be a traducian or a creationist to take a strong stand against abortion, for instance, because regardless of what else you say about it, that it is alive and it's a person. It's not a dog. It's not a tumor. It is a person you're killing. Person. That's wrong. Thou shalt not kill. You see what I'm saying? The biblical prohibition against taking innocent life stands whether you solve the problem of ensoulment or not. Okay, what I'm saying is that Pelagians would tend to be creationists, Augustinians would tend to be traducians. Why? Well, if you believe the soul is transmitted, then it helps, makes it easier to think of guilt being transmitted. The individual child is sort of a part of the unified whole of the human race. That kind of thinking. I define traducianism. Tradition is the belief that creation stopped after the 7 days of creation in Genesis and that man's soul or spirit is inherited from parents along with his body. Okay? So, y'all learn that term. If you're going to be a part of the abortion debate, that term comes up. And you'll be asked, by the way, this is one of those things that people ask you in the local church. It's a reasonable question. All I'm saying is that it is in the context of discussing abortion that it comes up today more often. Okay, that's the Pelagian view. And it's quite simple. Just, you want to remember what the Pelagian view is, just remember these words, which are the opposite of the three words which describe the Augustinian view. Pure, free, and innocent. Now listen, students. Do you understand which of these three words, pure, free, which word does pure stand in opposition to in the Augustinian view? Corrupt, free, bondage or bound, innocent, of course, guilt. So you all learn marking it down that way. It's a good way to learn it. A handy way to keep it straight in your mind. But then we come now to the semi-Pelagian view, which, as I pointed out when in the early Christian centuries course, technically, I call it the semi-Pelagian view because that is the traditional name given to it. Actually, it's a semi-Augustinian view, should be called. It's closer to Augustine than it is to Pelagius. You quantify it, I guess. So with that understanding, that actually it is semi-Augustinian, but it'd be ridiculous to call it that because when you read it, you wouldn't recognize what you're looking at when you read in other books or in books about it, because this is the standard term. And I always try in my courses to use the standard terms, even though often they're inaccurate, because it's not fair to the student to teach him a whole new vocabulary so he doesn't, when you pick up the books in that field, you don't know what you're looking at. Okay, the semi-Pelagian view is, first of all, that a baby is born corrupt, yet free and innocent. Corrupt, yet free and innocent. Man has inherited a tainted, corrupted nature, a leaning towards sin. He is depraved, but not totally depraved, not totally disabled in his will. Now, that is, a baby is not born guilty, his will is not bound, although his will is tainted, and he is born with a tendency to sin. He is not born in such a way that he is a complete sinner, though nothing that he does is good, does no good thing. But he is born with the leaning towards sin. Let me illustrate it this way, students. Augustine said that a baby is born flat on its back in all three areas. Guilty before God, totally his will destroyed, if he ever had one, if he had a free will, and is totally corrupted. Pelagius said, no, he's born standing straight up, pure, free, and innocent. Semi-Pelagian view is the baby's born like this. You know, not completely untainted, but not completely devastated. That helps you? It's a mediating view. Now, and the grand irony of this is, and I pointed this out, I'll come to that parenthetical consideration in a minute. Okay, I want you to understand the semi-Pelagian view. A baby is not guilty. He has some free will, and he has the tendency to sin. Yes, kind of a semi-Pelagian view, although not exactly, because the Baptists, he said that tradition, that was what the question Butch asked. They hold original sin, but they illogically lean toward a semi-Pelagian view. And it gets into some of the contradictions we've already talked about. Let me just point this out for you. See, if you held that a baby is born with Adam's sin, if a baby is born with his evil nature, then you would tend to convert him earlier than you would if you didn't. Tend to try to convert him earlier in life. I'm surprised nobody has asked me, what about the baby in a Pelagian view? What about the child who's, say, 5 or 6 years old and dies unbaptized?
What about the child that's 5 or 6 years old and dies?
I don't know.
That's what I asked.
Well, this is a, you understand? This is a question that you're going to be asked in the church, I promise you. And you better have an answer. And I'll give you the answer that I get. The Bible doesn't go into detail on it, but I'll give you my answer based on my understanding of the biblical doctrine of sin. That a child, say a five-year-old child, is neither saved nor lost. Saved. That is, we often think a child has to be lost for it to be saved. Do you ever hear this in a church? A child, a 7 or 8 year old child is raised in the Bible school, this bright child, you know, very alert, will be ready to be become a Christian. We'll seek you out and say, I want to be baptized. Inevitably, somebody in the church will say, well, what's he ever done that he needs to repent of? What is repentance for a five-year-old child that's living in a Christian home and been raised in a godly way? Well, repentance is simply the decision to be a child of God. You do not have to be guilty of great sin or be aware of guilt of great sin to be ready to become a Christian. That's the prodigal son view of things. What you have to do is understand the concept of sin and the need for forgiveness. And I'm convinced, again, this is an inference, that a young child, that very often children, especially those raised in Christian homes, go from being saved to being saved. That is, they go from a position where they do not need forgiveness to the place where they enter into. See, salvation is a state. You enter into the state of forgiveness. It's a position. In Christ is the position. Now, and the corollary to that is the question of, is childish misbehavior sin? See, Dobson would say yes. Childish misbehavior is sin. I say it isn't. Even if a child is doing something he's been told not to do, that doesn't mean, understand? A child can do something that he knows is wrong.